Although I don't have a lot of memories of my childhood, if I'm being honest. I just had a conversation with my partner today, and apparently your mom said when you were a kid, you ate a box full of gum, like chewing gum. You didn't shit for a week.
Just ate it. Just
apparently, I don't know. Wow. And I was like, I don't even remember that.
Isn't gum meant to be a laxative?
I don't know. Maybe that's where my gut issue started, bruh.
We would like to acknowledge that we are on stolen Yuggera and Turrbal lands, and as settlers of colour, we reflect upon the damaging legacy of colonisation. Always was, always will be.
My name is Sudesh. My Tamil name is Sudish. Sudish Somu. What I create is, I'd like to say, safe environment. Because I know you work with a lot of creative people and whatnot. And
yeah.
Like music, dance, yeah. And all that. And I was like, I have a lot of interest in dancing, I suppose. I come from a dancing background. But in a sense, what I create at this point in my life is probably safe environment. I am currently working with a non-for-profit organization, ADSICS, Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Community Health Services.
Uh-huh.
And I'm involved with one of their family well-being programs where I work directly with Indigenous young youth.
I see.
Disadvantaged. And provide them health and educational needs, like supports and, yeah, get them off the streets and doing the good thing. Yeah, that's what I'm doing. Yeah. So that's my full-time gig at the moment. I got side things happening as well outside. Yeah.
How did you get into that kind of work?
Probably goes back where I was quite young myself.
Yeah.
When I was about 14, I came to Australia as an asylum seeker from Sri Lanka. And I came into contact with a type of mentors that were able to guide me in this kind of path. Yeah, very inspiring people, I suppose. They picked out some of my strengths. So now I understand they captured and they, you know, did the strength-based model on me. I can see that because they captured that I liked dancing at that time.
Okay.
So they bought that out of me in the camps. Like I was a mongrel of a kid when I was in the camps, bro. I was running amok.
Yeah.
Because I was quite...
And when you're telling me about camps, can you tell me what that is like?
Yeah.
What kind of camps?
Yeah, we're talking about refugee detention camps. So we're talking about Christmas Island and Manus Island.
Yeah, wow.
So, I was detained with me. There were other children as well that was detained. I actually don't know how many children have actually come out and spoke about it. I'm very vocal about my experience because a lot of, you know, how it's being portrayed in the media these days, in my view, it is quite false because they are saying asylum seekers as in everybody, you know, especially right now what they're going on within the politics within the country. There's, you know, they're talking about, you know, with the criminals that are being released and when they name asylum seekers, it creates this fear. You know, I feel like people might think asylum seekers, you know, rapists, criminals,
excuse me, I'm
offended. And I'm disheartened because I live in Queensland now, man, and I've always lived in Queensland since I've come to Australia.
Okay.
And I'm a Queenslander.
Yeah.
You know, I've moved around Queensland, North Queensland, Northwest Queensland, like, you know, this is my home now.
Right.
So I want Queenslanders to have my back. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like I'm doing the right work. I'm doing the good job. I know that in my heart.
Yeah.
I am fulfilling my purpose.
Mm.
And I want to make sure, and I'm speaking directly to the people of Queensland to hold me strong because the things that are happening in the media around asylum seekers, and it's not good, man. They got to recognize the good people and they have to give them an opportunity to be in this country because some people have really lived some horrible lives, you know, and including myself and some of the children who were detained in Manus and Christmas Island and whatnot. So, yeah, I found myself in this position, man, where, you know, working with Indigenous kids now, and it's quite a fulfilling job, man. I traveled up North Queensland to Mount Isa. So I was working with Save the Children.
Uh-huh.
So this was the organization that used to take care of the kids there in Manus.
Right.
And I had caseworkers from Save the Children and whatnot. And
and
even when I was working in Mount Isa, so I was with Save the Children.
Okay.
So I went in as a worker. So which was a good experience in a sense, you know.
Mm, yeah.
So these kind of government facilities that get intentionally put offshore, like you mentioned Manus, Christmas Island, you know, Guantanamo Bay also sort of springs to mind. These Western governments have their own laws on their own land masses, and they go and set up something that's just a little bit out of reach, just a little bit out of our, beyond our laws, restrictions, mm-hmm. and definitely out of our sight. When, you know, I can say these words, Manus and Christmas Island, but there's few people like yourself that have gone through that so-called system, that experience. I've only seen, like, you know, gotten a small taste from, say, like a Manus documentary or that sort of thing where cameras were smuggled in. When you say Manus, what is the feeling, and then, like, what are your memories of that place?
It was a wild experience, if I'm being honest.
Yeah.
Because first of all, because the story doesn't just start there, you know, because I was already a hurt child.
Okay.
And living in that sort of environment was quite volatile, you know, violent,
yeah,
tense, traumatized people walking around everywhere, people that have escaped wars, persecution from different countries. We're talking Iran, Afghanistan, Pakistani, Sri Lankan,
yeah,
you know. So all sorts of people are walking in that camp who are quite hurt.
Yeah.
And I got to see a lot of violence there. And as a 14-year-old, I that's why I could resonate to the indigenous kids here so well.
Right.
Because, you know, they, you know, the drugs, the, you know, their behaviors, seeking comfort. They're seeking comfort from the wrong places. You know, they're like, I don't feel safe. I just want to, like, find it. So, you know what I mean? So like that, when I was a kid in the camps, I was just running amok. You know what I mean? And I'm able to recognize that now. But the experience is probably very lonely, extremely, extremely lonely. I don't even know how I can put that to words. And uncertain is an understatement, you know? It's like you're really in no direction in future. Like, you don't know where the future is. So I feel that throughout my life, it has been that way. And only now I have built up the courage to speak about that. You know, and I don't want to hold it back anymore. You know, like my experience from North Queensland as well, it was, you got to stand up for yourself. You know, you're going to stand up for yourself. And it's the same with Indigenous people. They say, you got to remember where you come from.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what I had to mentor and guide with some of the kids that I coached boxing, or, like, you know, and that's what I want to do that. I want to do exactly that.
So your passion is creating safe environments.
Yep.
We come from the same troubled and beautiful island of, known as many names, Sri Lanka, Ceylon, Elam, Taprobane.
I didn't even know that.
Oh, right. Yeah. But we are from different minority groups. My ethnic group is the Burgers, and we're kind of like, you know, no one was ever that fussed about us. Like, there was people that had conflict, and we lost our jobs, and we were in a privileged position so we could get out. And I'm a good case study in that. My parents worked in the Middle East, and then we migrated here. We were not forced to go down the asylum seeker pathway. We were not kind of, as far as I'm aware, we didn't have, like, direct threats on our life. Can you tell me what was your Sri Lankan childhood and family environment like that perhaps is what inspires you to create safe spaces today? And
My personal experience when I was growing as a kid in Sri Lanka was quite short. So we're just speaking literally, like, less than 2 years.
Right.
Yeah. So I was born in India.
Okay.
I was born in India to a parents who were essentially raised in refugee camps in India.
Wow.
Yeah. They were released. I mean, did they get released? We don't know. Like, they're refugees.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? yeah, so they just went on and lived in India. And living in India as from someone from a lower socioeconomic background, or especially a background of Sri Lankan, Tamil, Elam refugees. They were not registered, man. They were like, they were just living. They were experiencing constant discrimination, threats. Like, they couldn't even go to authority to gain help because they themselves weren't official to be there.
Okay.
Kind of thing. You know what I mean? So they still had their children there. And I got two sisters. Like, even in schools and that, I experienced quite a lot of bullying. You know, being a Sri Lankan Tamil has a lot of, for me personally, had a lot of impact, negative impact. And there were a couple of life-threatening experience in my life for my family in India. And it got to a point where my father said, we're going to go back to home country, which is like after the civil war ended in Sri Lanka.
Okay.
And when we went back to Sri Lanka, yeah, what can I say? Like, it was just wild, man. Like, my memory now is, like, so short because it was such a short period of time. It feels like...
So this is 2009, 2010.
Yeah, this is, like, we went back 2010.
Yeah.
Maybe, like, beginning of 2011, 2000... Yeah, somewhere around there. I, like, even with dates and years, I'm just so off.
Yeah.
I only remember when we arrived in Australia because it became a big deal. We had to remember that. It became, like, this is your ID, this is your number. Bang, you have to remember that date. That's the date you arrived, kind of thing. You know what
I mean?
Right,
right.
So in Sri Lanka, my memory is quite short, but also that's an effect of trauma as well.
Yeah.
You know, what I saw was I experienced, like, my snap memory is, like, stopping a lot while driving. I assume that's, like, checkpoints.
The checkpoints.
Yeah.
Right.
And I also, yeah, there were few altercations where we had people come into our house and we were threatened.
Which area were you living in when you moved?
Like, that's how
in
much
in the north?
Or? Yeah, in the north, of course, in the north. Yeah. But I don't know the exact location. I was a young kid. Even now to
so
this
So this is 12-13 before you came to Australia?
Yeah. This is when the world thought that Sri Lanka is all safe. Civil war had ended. We're all good now.
Yeah.
No, it wasn't. For me, it wasn't for my, it just wasn't, you know. And there was a moment where we came quite close to really, I don't know, I thought I was going to die. I thought my family was going to die.
Can you tell me about that moment?
We had a moment where we had officials come into our house and literally beat me and my dad up.
Sri Lankan government officials?
Yeah.
Military?
Yeah. Literally came and beat us up. And it was quite a scary time in my life, my brother, I have to tell you. I thought I was going to lose my family member and myself. I'll tell you that. And it was very unsafe for my mother and my sister, you know, and my father had to make a decision, man. But they left us, man. They left us. And that was a pivotal moment in our life. My father said, I don't know what he would have said to my mom at that time, but yeah, just we are out.
When you say they left us, like they left you with your lives?
Yeah.
Because they were that close?
Yeah.
Wow.
Straight up. Yeah, straight up.
Was it, not that any reason can justify this thing, but did they come in with any reasoning? Or it was just profiling your Tamil, we're going to show you?
Simple things, man. Simple, like exactly how it was and what the reason was. Power, you know,
intimidation,
authority, all that. And that's when really my journey has really started and my memory really like became strong after that. I feel like the experience in the camps, my experience in this country, I don't know what it is. For me personally, I feel like happiness, like in this country, you know, gave me more inspiration to meet people, say hello, come to the present.
Yeah.
I don't think I was in the moment back when I was a kid. I was probably always living in the future thinking, oh, it'd be better.
There's constant displacement.
Yeah. You kind of like you're disassociated in a sense. It's like you're not even there.
Your whole childhood.
brother, I don't have a lot of memories of my childhood, if I'm being honest.
Mm.
I just had a conversation with my partner today and she said, apparently your mom said when you were a kid, you ate a box full of gum, like chewing gum, and just, you didn't shit for a week.
Just ate it. Just
apparently, I don't know. Wow. And I was like, I don't even remember that.
Isn't gum meant to be a laxative?
I don't know. Maybe that's where my gut issue started, bruh.
Wow.
I don't know, man.
I mean, yeah. I mean, so that kind of thing is, yeah, consistent with the trauma process of disassociation, right? Like, interesting how you repeatedly say, it's like, I don't remember that place. I don't remember where we were. Like, you describe yourself as being a proud Queenslander and perhaps not recognized or accepted as such, but this is the home, only home you've known because you weren't able to put down roots prior to living here, right?
Spot on.
Hmm.
That's so spot on, brother.
And yet you, like many of us who don't perhaps look like the typical version of a Queenslander, we're sort of left in this liminal mid-space of not accepted there, back in our homes, or not accepted in this new home, this colony of so-called Australia, right? And so your dad makes this decision.
Mm-hmm.
What happens? How does he go about? Do you recall, or has he retold you since of like any of the logistical, like what do you do once you make that decision?
My memory was that we had to, I don't know if it was like literally the day after or a couple of days after, I just can't remember very much, but we had to be on this van and we went to a coastal place and they put us on a little boat, man, and which went on to another little bit bigger boat.
Yeah.
These are just fishing boats we're talking about.
Yeah.
Came through and it was about 18 days in total, the journey. But it also stopped in Indonesia.
Okay. Right. So it wasn't India. You just went direct southeast.
No, we were in Sri Lanka
at
that time.
Yeah.
No, we didn't go to India, Sri Lanka.
Mm.
Down.
And Australia was the goal?
I don't know at that time where the fuck we're going.
Yeah. Wow. What do you remember what you're told? Or just your whole childhood had been movement, so it was more movement.
Yeah, it was just, I knew we were going somewhere else. I didn't think we were going here.
Mm.
And I remember, but this memory I have is still like the ocean memory, man. The ocean was just day and night, day and night, day and night. Blue, 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 blue. Black, 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 black.
That's it. It was just
like that.
See.
That was all. It was all. It was like that. But while I'm in this topic, I think I should also like really respect and acknowledge the people that we've lost in ocean, people that have, you know, died.
Yeah.
And people, I also want to respect and acknowledge the people that have survived because it's not like a fun trip that somebody takes.
Yeah.
It's a life or death situation.
Last resort, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And when we speak about like when this issue comes up, the biggest topic is border security and also, you know, what's the people that help? What are they called? Smuggling.
Like so-called people smugglers.
Yeah, yeah. They talk about the smuggling part of it, but have they ever looked into the people that are actually struggling?
Mm.
Why are they doing that?
Yeah.
And there are people that are there. To like smuggling is there, like when people are in that kind of like live or die kind of situation, they're going to find help.
Mm.
They're going to find help, you know what I mean? And yes, it is true. You have to also take control of these smugglers. We don't want everybody to be smuggling into a country. And I do get that.
Yeah.
Security is very important to a country to a massive degree. Like we need to be safe for sure.
Yeah.
100%. But I think that's not the root cause. That isn't. You got to really look into people that are struggling in the world. And maybe it's also a belief that we can't fix the whole world.
Mm.
Maybe at least fix the people that are already here, man. Lived through those tough times.
Yeah, like support that trauma.
Yeah, exactly. Mm. I've already made it, have well contributed now, are also continuing to well contribute, are well integrated.
Mm.
You have to recognize them, right?
Mm, mm.
Like it is disheartening.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And because so much of this movement and the social political elements at play that keep this going is kind of connected to like the long shadow of colonization and you know, the particularly the extractive colonization that has come from South Asia that has, you know, forever changed that reason and that region. And we'll never know what, I mean, we can imagine what it could have been without it. But on that ocean journey, 13 days.
18 total.
18 days. Do you have some memories from that trip, apart from the monotony of the sort of cyclical?
I lay down my dad's belly. I was laying down my dad's belly.
Right.
That was my memory.
Yeah.
That's the memory I have.
Wow.
I was laying down my dad's belly. That's it. Nothing else. Salt water in the mouth as the waves crash.
Right.
I remember there was a point when we got close to the country, Christmas Island. We stopped. I don't think it moved anywhere. It didn't move anywhere for a couple of days.
And you were just on anchor.
Yeah. And there was some sort of chaos going around. Like the engine stopped working or something. People are panicking now. People are starting to panic now. And it happened, man. Like I remember seeing like Christians praying, Muslims praying, Hindu praying. Like everybody was just praying in the boat, just praying. And people panicking. And we saw a big helicopter go by. And then people just like from one end to the other end, the boat's going.
As they're reaching, or
they're just trying to make them wave. See. Yeah, make them see them. Yeah, so it's like they're moving now. So people are panicking. Stop moving this way. They're like, they're also like dizzy and all that. I could feel like boat going, you know? So there's a lot of chaos in the space. And that evening we had officials come in the, you know, we saw, I don't think that night we saw any Navy, but, you know, at the night, like a big boat, you know, the Navy ship, we didn't see that, but we just saw these officials come by on like a little jet kind of boat.
Yeah.
Like, you know, rubber balloon ones.
Oh, okay. Yeah.
Came on that and
just surveillance, just like doing a.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. They came and said, where are you from? And I'm something that I'm so grateful for is that mom and dad always valued education.
Yeah.
And they made sure that I can communicate. And they made me read since a young age as well.
In how many languages?
I can speak Tamil and English. Well, yeah, but I can understand other several like Hindi language as well. Yeah, but I can't speak it that well.
Okay.
I was just exposed to it.
Yeah, right.
You know, people speaking all the time, you know? So, yeah, so the officials came and I remember, you know, someone saying, yeah, we are asylum seekers, refugees from Sri Lanka, from Afghanistan, Iran, Iraq. We had 140 people in that boat.
140 left Sri Lanka in that boat? No. Or there was already people?
Yeah, along the way in Indonesia as well.
Oh, there Indonesia. Were,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah, people, yeah.
140 people?
Yeah.
In what size?
I don't know how big it, like.
No, it's hard to it picture
was,
the scale.
I don't think it was that big. It was a small fishing boat. And, you know, and we could have absolutely died. We could have absolutely died if we had no one come.
Yeah.
And we just left floating. The panic was that severe. Yeah. So as soon as, we were rescued, you know, I want to say thank you to the Australian Navy for rescuing us.
Yeah.
Because I do think we would have died, you know, like, yeah, for sure. Thinking back, man, like I was only 14. I don't even know where I was headed now. It all makes sense. Like, man, that's a dangerous path. When I have my kids, I don't think I could ever do that.
To them or with them?
Yeah, with them. Bro, it's a wild journey.
Yeah.
It's a wild journey. Like, it's a life-threatening journey to start with. You know, it's not 100% that you're going to make it.
Yeah.
It's likely you can die. That's how it is. So as soon as they rescued us, they took us to the big Navy ship that was in the ocean as well. It was massive. They took us in and they gave us food. And then off to Christmas Island for a month, you know, before we went in, you know, we had to like sit down and give our names and what all that. But, you know, I could see, I was young at that time, right?
Yeah.
I could, I mean,
and it's a detention center, prison-like facility.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah. And keep in mind as well, my mom and dad are still humans who have also tried now to essentially provide safety for their children, right?
Right.
You can understand the panic they would be in. Like, we made it, but these are officials. They are taking us, we sat down, they got our names. Now they're taking us into this big, we don't know where we're going.
Yeah.
Like, it doesn't look too friendly either. Like, we got big mass security guards. They're like, there's no humanitarian, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Feeling to it.
Yeah,
you know? But to a certain degree, hear me out on this one. Hear me out on this one.
Yeah.
To a certain degree, I do get Australia's when they say border security, when they say, you know, we want to keep the country safe. I get that.
Mm.
We want to make sure the country is safe.
Mm.
Get that, 100%. But you must also recognize people that have genuinely gone through persecution and wars, you know, and tremendous, tremendous life challenges. And these are genuine people. And now for Australia, I feel like at this point, with the track record of the people that are already here in this country, how do you know a person's history? You're getting to know me right now.
Yeah.
Right. Obviously, conversation helps.
Mm.
But to really genuinely find out a person who they are is to track record.
Mm.
All right?
Yeah.
So people are already here. I'm not giving a solution, but I think this is something they should consider.
Mm.
Like, thousands of people are in your country right now who are struggling, who are uncertain. A simple, like literally, character reference can make a massive difference.
Right.
Don't you think? Like, okay, get that. This person could just make up a character reference. You officialize the character reference. Who do we need to go through to actually prove that we are genuine people? Like, we've already gone through so many systems of immigration, like where we give our interviews, we tell our stories, and if they reject that, we take it to the federal circuit court, and they usually circuit courts are okay. Like, we've had positive outcomes from the court. I've had positive outcome twice, and third time it's in the court again, and I'm hopeful it will come back successful. Yeah. And it goes back to Immigration Assessment Authority, and they reject it. They find some sort of odd errors, or like, oh, this we can't see how you were in danger 10, 11 years ago, or this.
So arriving at 14,
yeah.
How long ago was that now?
2012.
So, 12 years?
No, 14 at that time. That was 2012. I was 14 years of age in 2012.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so now turning 26 this year, actually.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
When we talk about not being accepted as a Queenslander, why are you still dealing with immigration? What's going on for you?
That's a really quite good question. I don't even know. Because we said the story, man. We presented what our problems are. I don't know what is wrong. Straight up, honestly. How many times have we got to present our cases? How many times have we got to relive our traumas? That's enough. Like, I want full stop to that.
Yeah.
That's enough.
So you're stuck in this cycle. What is the status for you? Can you get a driver's license? Like, what do you
currently have? I'm on a bridging visa.
What does that mean?
That means I can work. Certain bridging visas don't have study rights, so I can't study. I don't have the rights to study.
At all.
I don't have the rights to study. So I can't go to TAFE or university.
Okay.
Can't study, bro.
No matter how, before you even get into
financial
hex,
matters, no, does not doesn't, even, doesn't even, we're not even talking about
that. You can't enter
that.
An educational
can't
institution.
Enter, I can't.
Wow.
Yeah, it's pretty strict. It's cruel and brutal.
Okay.
So right now I have bridging visa, so I can officially work and like legally work. I mean,
okay,
for tax and all that kind of stuff. But I went through a period with my family where we had our bridging visas expired because we had a legal representative at that time who we thought would do that piece of work as well as the court submissions.
Right,
but he didn't because he goes.
Also, the agent messed up.
Yeah, he goes, well, I thought, well, you know, my job is only submission work. I don't do no visa application work. You can find somebody else. And I'm thinking, bro, are you serious?
Wow.
Bro, are you serious? This is our life, man. Now we can't work. How are we supposed to pay rent? 2.5 years. 2.5 years.
With no paperwork.
It was illegal for us to work.
Your whole family?
Yeah, bro. 2.5 years. It was how, like, of course we had to bring in bread. Of course we had to pay rent. How are we supposed to become homeless then?
So no access to services, no access to benefits or education.
Nothing.
And not allowed to work.
Exactly. That's what I'm talking about, bro. Like, and now I could be found, you know, doing the wrong for working. No, I'm going to speak up about that now because I'm not afraid of it because it's unconstitutional.
Mm.
Like, come on. What are we talking about?
That's just, yeah, just like senseless bureaucracy just layered on top of each other just to equal just complete madness. Yeah.
Stupid, man. It's really stupidity.
2.5 years.
2.5 years, bro. I struggled, man.
How did you get out of that?
So at that time, I was in Mount Isa. So in total, I was in Mount Isa for 3.5 years. For the first year, I was getting paid properly and working actually. They used to fly me. My job was awesome in Mount Isa. Listen to this. So I go there for 3 weeks. So they pay me for my flights and accommodation.
Yep.
I do my job. My job being youth practitioner. I was working for Men's Behavior Change Program at that time.
Uh-huh.
So I work with men who were using domestic violence. And my job was to facilitate with a facilitator about behavior change and doing safety plans and the impacts of violence.
Yeah, yeah.
So that was my work. And visa expiry, brother. You can't work no more. That's it. You can't. And I said, I love my job right now. I can't stop this because if I go back to Brisbane, I got to like clean and because I don't have no trade background. I'm not really like handy, you know, like. Yeah. I've always done this kind of work. I'm a people person.
Yeah.
I like working with people. Now it's illegal all of a sudden.
Mm.
So I asked the organization I was with, listen, please, you don't need to pay me. I know it's illegal. Why don't you fly me up, give me accommodation, and provide me food? I will volunteer for you.
Wow. And that happened?
Yeah.
Wow.
And they did that for me.
How long did you keep that up?
2 years and 2.5 years, something like that.
Wow.
Yeah, bro. Straight up.
That was survival.
That was like straight up. And I loved it. I thrived off that and it was tough. It was hard. It was straight
what did,
up.
What did they say? I mean, that's a dream for the organization. Like, we get to have you for free. Like, what did they say?
Yeah, I mean.
Were they appreciative?
Yeah, they were very appreciative. They gave me valued member of like 2021. They gave me like a Asia Pacific recognition kind of thing.
Wow.
Which was quite incredible. Like I cried, I rang my dad and I said, Dad, look at this, Dad. They gave me like Asia Pacific recognition kind of thing. I was like, wow. So it was quite an incredible moment. And and I mean, obviously you need money, right? I need money.
Yeah.
Like I got to pay my phone bill. I also have this, you know, autoimmune condition. I got to take medication and that for.
Okay.
So it's like, well, I need money. So I'm a personal trainer as well. I coach boxing. So in Mount Isa, there was this boxing gym called Derek's Boxing where I was heavily involved with. I was coaching kids. I was also training. Training is my outlet.
Yeah.
I let my, like, all my rage out through training. So
tell me about that boxing journey. Did that start out there?
No, it started in actually camp. It started in Manus, when we were in Manus. There was this Iranian guy that used to take some of the boys through boxing drills. Part of like exercise kind of thing. He did that maybe like 4 times, I would say.
Yeah.
And then all of us boys would just like do push-ups and pull-ups and all that kind of stuff. So we understood the kind of like, oh, being active is pretty fun. Like we can move our body because there was nothing to do there.
Yeah.
In the camps. So
how long were you based?
Where?
How long were you under detention there?
In total, in Manus, 8 months.
Okay.
Yeah. And when I came to Brisbane here after high school, so during high school I was doing karate. So, and then not competitive, just like disciplinary kind of thing.
Yeah.
And then when I finished high school, I didn't know what I wanted to do. I wanted to do personal training. I was sure about that because I like exercise. Maybe I like people to also exercise and experience the benefits of that. So when I finished when I'm about to finish my course, the teacher said, I know you like martial arts and that. Why don't you try boxing? And not to compete, but to actually do your... you know when they do like the hours, they have to do certain hours for that course, placement.
Oh, okay,
So you can do your placement at this boxing gym. And that was a boxing gym at West End here, Dundee's Boxing and Fitness.
Right.
Where that was the first time I was exposed to the sport, the combat sport of boxing.
Okay.
And I came from like karate background. I thought, oh, I can karate chop people. I'll be all right. But nah, you got your head punched in. So you know, which I did, and I was humbled, and I realized I need to really learn this sport if I want to coach and become a personal trainer. And like, you know, so at that time, Dundee, who was the owner of the gym, he recognized and I wanted to work hard.
Mm.
So he put me, he trained me, and he also like took me into like boxing competitions and that, a couple of them. And I also fought out of another boxing gym in West End. My vision is not like, I want to continue boxing and become a world champion. Nah, none of that. So boxing combat is animal sport.
Okay.
Like you have to really have that like killer instinct in you to like keep going. It doesn't matter.
To be competitive.
Like, yeah, to be competitive. It's like a different kind of, you know, so I respect that.
Yeah.
Hence, I don't want to go into that path.
Yeah, okay.
You know, like I want to stick to where I thrive the most at, like, you know, which is coaching. I enjoy coaching and I understand psychology as well to a massive degree.
Yeah.
When it comes to people going through combat moments in their mind as a sport. So I think I found myself when it comes to that sport. So I enjoy the coaching aspect more than the competitive aspect.
Right.
I still train, spar every now and then, but haven't really fought in a while. But boxing is one of those things as well. When you feel good, you'd feel like you want to fight again. You know what I mean? My gut hasn't been that great. I've got some health issues at the moment. Mm. I had autoimmune ulcerative colitis. And this condition is autoimmune. It's not so great. It's basically inflammation in your like colon.
Okay.
So it will get better naturally, but I also have to like get medical help.
Right.
For this, the Western medicine believes there is no cure to this.
Yeah. You know?
But I think our people, I mean, the Southeast Asians, they have different kind of approach to it. You know. So I'm trying at various, you know, methods, but also I've really gotten my family involved in the healing process.
Hmm.
So I'm really like connecting to myself, eating the right food. And I think environmental factor has had a massive contribution towards my illness now. Because when I came here, I think a whole lot of processed foods, you know, to Australia.
Yeah.
A lot of processed food. I'm sure the environmental change, the trauma would have had an impact. Absolutely. On, you know, dis-ease, you know, that's what it is. It's dis-ease.
Mm.
So it's not, so I'm coming to recognize that now. Mm. So I'm just slowing it down at the moment and just enjoying the training aspect of it and people connection, all that kind of stuff.
Okay, right. Yeah.
What do you do? What's your outlet? Like, what do you do?
My outlet? I think when I was growing up, it was the playing the drums and like heavy music and going to metal gigs and like
mad.
That sort of thing. Having a drum kit and just being able to just smash it out or just like kind of get into like music as a meditation and just be jamming with friends in the rooms for hours and like hardly speaking, just communicating with your instrument. I think that sort of was growing up. And I think more recently, I try to remind myself of some of those childhood things and like, playing with like drum pads or like getting back into basketball. But I think dance is another one. So like trying to DJ and or dance. And
tell me about your dance background.
Go out dancing. It's a little bit of a sad story because I was a hyper energetic kid, and my parents sort of just kind of noticed that amount of movement, and then they took me to a dance school, which happened to be a ballet dance school. And I was like in there and really energetic and like the only boy and I think like enjoying it until I came into the first year of kindergarten. And then the teacher probably made a bit of a bad sequence of questions where she was just like asking like who does this thing? Who plays soccer? Or who does running and like who does ballet? And like all the girls and me stood up, and then I was like pointing and thing and laughing. And so like that was like a, you know, just grinding up against gender norms. And I just like instantly pulled back and just stopped doing it. And it's quite unfortunate because I had like a big gap in dance for a long time. And now I go along to these, Bring a Plate dance community nights on Mondays. They're just kind of like a pretty low key inclusive, like out on the street type public movement event. We just learn a relatively simple, approachable bit of choreography to one song each Monday night. And yeah, I go along to that and kind of collaborated with them on a few videos. And I took the pedal party DJ bike to a groove session that they ran last Friday, which is super fun to go and do that. But I, you know, you speak of boxing, like I found this this boxing thing on the side of the road once and just brought it home. It's like a punching bag, but it's got a base, and I just got it out there. And just occasionally I'll just like come and just like get
punch
in.
It out.
Yeah, just like punch it out in that. And yeah, I feel like having outlets is quite important. Yeah, I was attending one of the national marches against men's violence against women this morning, and there's a real kind of reckoning within the country that has seen 32, 33 intimate partner deaths of... It's funny, these phrases, right? Like violence against women or intimate partner deaths, like as many people and scholars and women have pointed out, they kind of like erase men from that conversation. Like when we say violence against women, it's like, oh, this thing that's just happening, but it's actually... you know, men who are the perpetrators. And so I think a bit of big reckoning that's been happening with these rallies is a lot of the kind of terminology and thinking around it, when kind of labeling it as men's violence against women. And it's yeah, interesting for us being two men talking about outlets and boxing and that kind of thing. We can try and provide these spaces and encourage people, men in particular, to find these outlets so that they are not perpetrated in just like the horrible ways that we keep on seeing in this so-called first world country, right?
Definitely, man. Definitely. Yeah. Growing up, I saw a lot of violence in my life, heaps.
Yeah.
Domestic violence being one of them.
Right.
And I love my dad, man. I love my dad. Mm. I love my mom. Mm. Family means everything to me.
Yeah.
But what they... grew up from, that's what they knew, that's what they saw, that was their belief, you know. And I saw a lot of violence, and even when we came to Australia, you know, my father was quite violent, and it took, like, there was a time where I had to step in and push my dad physically,
right?
It was a tough time, and I went into my room feeling guilty and like, oh, dad. And you know, my dad, he was also heightened state. He walked in, he goes, oh, you're a big man now, huh? You're going to hurt me. Like, I know I'm painting this bad picture on my father right now.
Yeah.
But I love him for the man he is now.
Mm.
The transformation he's made. My father is a true example that transformations can be made.
Right, right.
100% can. You know what I mean? I do believe that, because people's past, it's a pattern of behavior. And behavior is what it is. And it's down in your psychology as well. It's your belief around it. It's about changing those patterns of behaviors. And you got to go deep into your belief. And that can only happen in safe environments.
Right, right, yeah.
And this is the sort of work that was happening in Mount Isa. I loved it, man. And I learned a lot about, you know, the impact of violence. And violence does go both ways, you know. Men are affected by violence as well.
Mm.
But the percentage is just outrageously
like
crazy. Mm.
Definitely.
So that's where I do think men do need to speak about violence more. You know, it is an issue. Openly speak about it, like, because I know this is a problem.
Absolutely. Mm. Yeah. And I feel like that approach that you're describing is something along the lines of like, you know, calling someone in. Like, there's this phrase of like, you know, calling it out. And like, oh, they're the perpetrator, they're the bad person. But there's also like in the right situation when you feel safe being that person, or you're in a position, perhaps like a father-son type relationship, when you have the capacity to call someone in and help support them and maybe work through what they're going through, then that can help, you know, transform some of those behaviors like you've described with your with your dad. And
for sure.
And like, as so many people have been saying at the march this morning, and in this idea of men's violence against women, reiterating that it's a men's problem and something that we need to work together, and whether that's in small duo chats or men's groups, or people coming together and figuring out strategies and outlets and functional solutions to this horrible problem that is still not only we're not even counting the injuries, but we're counting some of the most extreme cases, and it doesn't sort of bode well with this nice, civilized, developed first world country idea that we think we have. A lot of Australians would like to point the finger at places like India or other parts of the world, and look at how they, how those men treat the women. Look at how these men treat the women, and or treat women, not them. It's atrocious here. It's right under our noses. It's it's in the very parliament itself. Some of those experiences in was it Mount Isa?
Yeah.
Was it the time when you were volunteering? Or what kind of transformations did you see, and what were some of the approaches or techniques that you saw were successful?
We had a facilitator that came from Brisbane, Anthony Newcastle. He's an Indigenous man, and in Mount Isa, large Indigenous population. There's also Caucasian people as well there, as well as it's quite multicultural, if I'm being honest.
Yeah,
and violence against, men perpetrating violence against women across all sort of, ethnicity, ethnical background. But because the Indigenous population was quite high as well, and within these remote communities, because they are the higher percentage in the correction centers as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Overrepresented.
Yeah, 100%. So we had a facilitator come directly to communities like Mount Isa. There were other communities, small communities like Dumaji, Mornington Island, Normanton, all these smaller communities. And he would deliver sessions to these men who would be released from correction centers on bail orders, who I would get. I will be able to get access of these the information of these men about their cases. And I'll have to make an assessment on what the history is of this person, whether they have experienced trauma and whatnot. And my goal is to refer them and connect with services that will provide them that therapeutic support. Usually it's, therapeutic approach mostly. Most of the time it works because it's them not understanding why they are where they are. They just can't seem to see why they are there. And this is another saying that I love from Isa as well. In order to know where you're going, you have to remember where you come from. So that's another, we made sure we had that approach when we are working with men who came in our caseload as, perpetrators of violence. And we literally sat down and have human conversations. I used to let these these men are going through challenging times themselves too. They've seen violence themselves. Drugs and alcohol is present in their life. And they are misplaced. A lot of them are misplaced. Some of them come from smaller communities. They're like, I'm going to live with my auntie or uncle. And then 10 years later, their life is here and so disconnected to who they are actually. They don't know their own tribes. They don't know. Now, as the society is all changing, social media, phone, technology, now everybody wants to be gangsters. No one wants to really learn or hear from their elders. So there's disconnection there. So the answer really is connection.
Right.
You got to be connected to where you come from. Back to connection, back to your roots. So that can be done by the elders and that country's traditional people to guide that to their young people. 100%. In Mount Isa, I know a couple of people that I want to give a massive shout out to. Derek Cusack, James Derrick, Kerry Derrick. So these people are quite young, but they're they're literally community leaders. They initiate things. They have boxing gyms. Derek, my mate, he's got barbershop happening.
Right.
He's teaching young kids how to barber. He's teaching skills. So it has to be led by role models, whether it be, they're breaking the laws or perpetrating violence. has to be done by role modeling methods. You know, you have to have the right role model and mentors teaching them, hey, listen, men, this is men's responsibility. As going back to your roots again, being a provider, being a protector. We are not somebody that perpetrates violence. That's pain. We are giving pain to the other person.
Mm.
So us as men, our responsibility is to be a provider and a protector. So it's through that kind of teaching, I believe. And that's the sort of work that happened in ISA. And we did a lot of safety planning as well. What do you do when you feel heightened?
Right.
Where do you go? Usually it's I just go for a walk, you know. My head's all up. I'm going angry.
Yeah.
I can't stay in the house because my missus will piss me off even more.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I just want to, you know, like they're so authentic. They're so real. Because that's what they've been seeing. That's what they've been, like, you know, monkey see, monkey do.
Mm.
You know, so we give them strategies. Who can you talk to? So we create number of people and their contact numbers. Usually we'll have the worker's contact number in the safety plan as well.
Right.
And we'll literally give it to them and put it in your pocket.
Mm.
Leave it in your pocket. Do you have a phone? No, I don't have a phone, brother. So you can go to this place, you know, you can go to this, your uncles, they have a phone, right? So we literally, it's very like real safety planning.
And when you say safety planning, is that with the consciousness that the men themselves are being conscious that they're going to be the ones that are possibly going to be making things unsafe, so that knowing that they need to remove themselves from the
100%.
Situation.
Wow. You're telling that to them. Hey, listen, if you're there, you know for a fact, if you're drunk, you're going to be in a heightened state and you're going to be present in that moment. Whatever your partner says, you're going to get angry at them.
Yeah.
So you have to recognize that. What are your signs? We break it down. What are your body signs?
Mm.
Oh, I feel the tension, the heat in my body. I feel myself clenching my hands, my jaws, butt teeth biting. They break it down to you.
Yeah.
And we go, so in future, when this kind of, it's hard. It's hard to recognize that. And like, you have to break it. Like, it's really a therapeutic work.
Yeah, yeah.
It's really a therapeutic.
And preemptive, right? Like you're sort of like.
Yeah, letting them go that path. You want to like fish them in.
Yeah.
Like you want to like, you want them to see that that's what they do.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you go, oh, okay. These are the alternative I need to try now. I need to go for walks. This is really why I think in communities or anywhere, there has to also be spaces. Like, it doesn't always have to be gyms. It can also be like community centers and that. They have to have safe space for men who are going through challenging, tough times. They're struggling mentally. They really are. They're really lost. So they need safe space and people that they can trust where they can go and speak, where they can be truly authentic in themselves, who are non-judgmental, don't have bias, and like they could have done some horrible things in the past.
Yeah.
But if we are going to be horrible back to them, that's not going to get them anywhere. It's just going to take them, bring them back to the same place.
And push them into a corner.
Exactly.
Mm.
Like it's tough, but it's, daunting task.
Yeah, I've been hearing of a similar program in Mbantwa, Alice Springs, and obviously we're hearing lots of reports of more youth issues and youth troubles at the time, but in recent news and with the curfew and that kind of thing. But I think, similarly, you know, it's a how big's ISA?
I don't know, maybe like 10,000 people.
Yeah,
20,000, maybe 10,000 to 20,000 people.
Right. Yeah. So Alice is only like around three times that in terms of the urban community there. But I think we're sort of grappling with, you know, it's not just rural community, it's not just rural indigenous communities, it's urban community, it's a completely cross-cultural, cross-socio-economic issue that we experience in so many ways. And if there's ways that we can kind of get in there, get people like yourself, like with their expertise, and can kind of call people in and build up these patterns within men, do you call it at-risk men, or is that a term that's used? Or
no, usually like women at risk is usually what they say,
okay,
like when they're fleeing domestic violence. And
is there a term for potential perpetrators?
No, I can't recall or recognize a word that refers. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay.
you could say men at risk.
Men too. At risk, yeah.
You could, I suppose.
Men at risk of perpetrating violence.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. Mm. You mentioned a couple of times of, you know, wishing for this state of Queensland to have your back. What would it be like for you to feel like that? What would need to happen?
I need more Queensland state members and also public to recognize, more importantly, the public to recognize the diagram that is being drawn on asylum seekers.
Mm.
Please be careful. Please. Please be careful of how they are being portrayed. You can't pick 100 bad people for 20,000 good people. Like, you can't draw a bad, like, statement for the whole cohort because this group of people, the smaller group of people, have done something wrong.
Right.
Hey, keep them accountable.
Yeah.
Like, if they've done something wrong, keep them accountable.
Right.
I'm not saying no to that. You do that. Like, I don't want anybody to be unsafe in my home either. I want my family to be safe, and I want the same for Queensland too. But if you can please recognize the people that are well contributing and are already well integrated into the community, I think you should give them a fair go. Mm. You should give them an opportunity and speak up for them. Don't be ashamed. Like, I'm not ashamed. Like, if you're, I've been here and I've been to Kedron State High School. I went to Kedron State High School here in Brisbane, Kedron.
Yeah.
If you're a mate of mine, if you've known me at school, you speak, bruh. Like, you know me.
Yeah.
You know me, brother. So, like, if there is something that's going on about, oh, asylum seekers are this, no, please, man. You have to understand, like, this is what education is.
Yeah.
This is what conversations can do.
Mm.
Get to have really connect with people and really understand the complexity behind it. This is bureaucracy. It is.
Yeah.
Right? To a certain degree, I get it. Unfortunately, we have to, brother. Like, in order to run a country like Australia, Australia is a really good country, man.
Mm.
I am so grateful to be in this country. I cannot, like, there is not enough words to describe how grateful I am to be living here in this country and to be a member of this community.
Mm.
I do feel like a member of community. I know that. I know that, and my family as well. And there are thousands of people like me who feel the same. The issue is that we still feel unsafe and uncertain about our futures. There are children who are born here, yet parents don't have any residence, yet children have residence.
Mm.
How does that work?
Mm.
Come on now. You know, let the family feel safe for once. They've already experienced enough challenges, uncertainty in their lives. Now it's time for the healing process to take place. Let's rebuild this. You know, like, my words, I want to say that I'm speaking for the community of good asylum seekers who have well contributed, well integrated into the community. 100%. I'm not speaking for the people that have done wrong.
Mm.
Don't count me with them.
Yeah.
Listen, that's it, period. Because I want to be proud of who I am. I want to stand up for who I am. That's it. And I'm not going to tell no authority to tell me, oh, you need to go back. What? It's not happening, bro. This is my home.
Mm.
That's what I call unconstitutional. It's not. It's not right, man. It's not right. Me, as a child being detained in Papua New Guinea, was not right. You traumatized me. There's a lot of things that were done bad. Now it's time to reshape that. Bad things I've done in the past, now it's time to rebuild the future. That's how it should be.
Wow. It's clear that you love this country, and I hope that, you know, this country can show you a bit of love back. And I really wish you the best of luck with your vision to continue to create safe environments. And I want to thank you so much for coming on Creative Tales today.
Thank you, brother. I appreciate it, man. It means a lot to me. the engine stopped working or something. People are panicking now. I remember seeing like Christians praying, Muslims praying, Hindu praying. Like everybody was just praying in the boat, just praying, praying, and people panicking. And we saw a big helicopter go by. So there's a lot of chaos in the space. The officials came, and I remember someone saying, yeah, we are asylum seekers, refugees from Sri Lanka, from Afghanistan, Iran, Iraq. We had 140 people in that boat.
140 people?
Yeah.
In what size?
I don't think it was that big. It was a small fishing boat. We could have absolutely died if we had no one come and we just left floating. We were rescued. I want to say thank you to the Australian Navy for rescuing us.
Yeah.
Because I do think we would have died for sure. Thinking back, man, like I was only 14. I don't even know where I was headed. Now it all makes sense. Like, man, that's a dangerous path. In order to run a country like Australia, Australia is a really good country, man.
Mm.
I am so grateful to be in this country. Like, there is not enough words to describe how grateful I am to be living here in this country and to be a member of this community. I do feel like a member of community. I know that, and my family as well. And there are thousands of people like me who feel the same. The issue is that we still feel unsafe and uncertain about our futures. There are children who were born here, yet parents don't have any residence, yet children have residence.
Mm.
How does that work?
Mm.
Come on now. Let the family feel safe for once. They've already experienced enough challenges, uncertainty in their lives. Now it's time for the healing process to take place. Let's rebuild this. Like my words, I want to say that I'm speaking for the community of good asylum seekers who have well contributed, well integrated into the community. 100%. I'm not speaking for the people that have done wrong.
Mm.
Don't count me with them. Listen, that's it, period. Because I want to be proud of who I am. I want to stand up for who I am. And I'm not going to tell no authority to tell me, oh, you need to go back. What? It's not happening, bro. This is my home.